Hello, and welcome to the WWIA Podcast. We're honored to have you join us in our mission to bring honor, connection, and healing to America's combat-wounded Purple Heart heroes. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, we welcome you. If you're a returning listener, thanks for coming back. Please be sure to tell others about our podcast and leave us a review if you're enjoying what you're hearing. It's an honor to introduce you to some of America's remarkable combat-wounded veterans. Sharing their stories and experiences with all of you is a high privilege. This week on the WWIA Podcast, WWIA founder and CEO John McDaniel welcomes an outstanding Purple Heart hero to the broadcast, Mr. Jason Gaudet. Jason proudly served in the United States Army for 20 years, traveling across the globe before retiring in 2014 while stationed in Alaska. He currently serves as an administrative specialist for the Naval Information Warfare Center. Jason is an avid outdoorsman whose love for hunting and fishing started at a young age. He's traveled throughout the United States hunting for moose, caribou, black bear, as well as fishing for giant halibut and salmon in Alaska. He's always in search of his next adventure and enjoys sharing his knowledge with others along the way. Jason currently lives with his wife Julie and son Jackson in South Carolina, where they enjoy getting outside to fish and hunt as often as possible. Without further ado, let's join John and Jason now.
Hi, my name's John McDaniel, founder and CEO of the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation, and this is our podcast, Honor, Connect, Heal. You know, today I have all my guests are special. This fine American is also very special. I have Jason Gaudet with me. Good morning, good afternoon, Jason. How are you?
Good, John. How you doing?
Good morning. Good. So let me set this up for everybody. Jason is a former Army soldier. He ascended to the rank of Sergeant First Class, which is a high-ranking non-commissioned officer. He's airborne all the way, so he's been in the 82nd, a few airborne units. He's a combat veteran with a Purple Heart. Where's your MOS? You're an 11 Bravo?
Okay,
excellent.
I was
excellent.
11 Bravo.
So 11 Bravo, you know, that's an infantryman, airborne and all that scary stuff. We'll talk about that. But you earned a Purple Heart as a result of a combat deployment you were on. You're a WWIA certified and trained guide, and you've been with the foundation for how long now, Jason, you reckon?
Just about 5 years. October
okay,
will be 5 years.
So coming up on 5 years, performing this mission. Yep. Across the country on one of our 40 some odd events. So anyway, hey, it's great to have you. It's good to see you again. You know, I think the first time we met would have been, I'm going to say, was it guide school or was it Erie? Do you remember?
It was okay. At guide school. I believe you were supposed to come up there to Erie, but, mission happened. But I ended up meeting you the first time at guide school in South Dakota.
Right. That's right. Okay. Very good. Yep. Very good. So, yeah, and I've been really, you know, impressed with you. You know, you have this very calm, confident demeanor about you. I think as an infantryman myself, I have a tendency to gravitate towards those that are, you know, in the combat arms, especially the infantrymen. You and I are both jump masters. And all the way, right? I mean, I was never in the 82nd. you certainly were. Probably have fallen out of more planes than I have. Probably have performed the task of jump mastering more than I have. But nonetheless, I have a very soft spot in my heart for those who, will throw themselves or jump out of a perfectly good airplane, if you will. But anyway, so tell us about your military career. People are really interested, and then we'll talk about, you know, getting wounded. But just in general, if you don't mind, Jason, tell us about your military career.
Sure thing, John. So I joined the military at 17 years old. I was one of those folks who had to have both their parents, you know, sign the waiver form. So, and I turned 18 in basic training, So I actually joined at 17. You know, did the whole Fort Benning and Fort Benning AIT in OSUT, and you know, was stationed in Fort Drum for my first duty station. And my squad leader told me about this wonderful, great thing called the airborne community. And so, and he said, you want to go to the best place on earth, you need to go to Vicenza, Italy. So that's where I started out my initial airborne time there.
But you'd already been to, you know, you'd already been to jump school, right? I mean, you hadn't been to jump school.
No, I re-enlisted for airborne school option and then with a duty station.
Okay, so what time are you? You're at Fort Drum. What year are we talking about?
I was this was 1997.
Geez, I was in
94 to 97. I was in Drum, and then went to airborne school. Went to Italy. You know, really realized that I liked the airborne stuff. And a friend of mine, you know, said, hey, you know, we got this jump master school coming up here in a few days. You want to go? I was like, nah, man, I don't want to do that. No, I'm good. I like just jumping out of the planes and everything. And so we stayed up all one night, you know, studying, went and passed pretest and had, you know, the bare minimum, had the 12 jumps and graduated first time go through airborne school or jump master school. And it was all over from there.
Okay.
Now I loved throwing people out of aircraft.
Wow. Well, that's so great. You know, I don't know how, you know, when I went to jump master school, I was, I had just left 3rd Ranger Battalion and I, you know, there's no time for officers really. I don't want to say no time, but you know, in the regiment, they generally won't, you know, let or have officers go to jump master school. It does happen, but for me, it didn't make a lot of sense. You know, you're rangering, you got these great NCOs that are, you know, performing that job, which they should be doing, jump mastering, you know, aircraft, high performance aircraft. You know, essentially, for those that don't know, a jump master, he or she certifies jumpers, airborne parachutists that fall out of planes, various different platforms, you know, C-130, C-141, C-5As, helicopters, you know, all the rotary wing aircraft and fixed wing that are capable platforms to jump out of. And it's a means of delivery, right? That's how you get to work, you know, and
it's the quickest way to work,
get an airplane, you know. And And, you know, if I had a nickel for every time I got on a plane, I didn't exactly know where we were going.
Right.
they call it vertical envelopment, right? You know, I mean, you got paratroopers, high-speed paratroopers descending on your position time now in the middle of the night. That's kind of a scary thing if you're a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, and when you combine that, like they did, you know, in Market Garden and other, you know, airborne operations throughout our nation's history, you know, you think about airborne. We're going to talk about airborne. I've never talked about that on a podcast yet. So let's go there. But, you know, this idea of packing troops in an airplane and getting them all rigged up either before they get on or doing an in-flight rigging when they're on the plane, that's a lot of fun, right?
Those are not a lot of fun.
No, they're not. And you know, I swear, well, I was just going to say it, you know, because you've been there. Anybody who has any experience in the jump master arena or, you know, airborne arena, you know, it looks and it sounds kind of fun. But the reality is that, you know, I don't want to say it's not fun because that's, you know, it's exciting. I could get your heart thumping. But as a leader, you know, you've got all these things going on in your mind, like, okay, you know, we're going to go, you know, it's like phase, you know, it's like phase one of your operation, right? I mean, you just got to, you know, getting your troops to the battlefield, the right place, right time with the right kit. There's lots of ways of doing that. And jumping out of a plane, you know, if you're doing a mass tactical airborne operation, that means mass tactical, meaning you got multiple airframes, you know, big unit, say a battalion's worth, you know, maybe even a larger brigade, you know, company, battalion, brigade, they're cross-leveled, across multiple aircraft. You don't have a quarter of my units in my plane, maybe even less, right? Mm-hmm. So you got key leaders, yep, and key weapon systems distributed across all these airframes. And then you got the jump masters inside who are, you know, kicking butt, getting ready to, you know, jump. It's in the middle of the night. Guys, they're flying these aircraft, nap of the earth before you get to the target, meaning your terrain following it, you know, 500 feet, 300 feet, and then you pop up to, you know, an altitude that is, you know, safe to jump. But by the time you get there, guys are getting sick. You know, the inside of the aircraft is, you know, full of puke bags, and I know, we're looking at each other going,
That poor safety.
Exactly, right. And, you know, they open the doors and the little barf bags are snaking out towards the door, you know. Guys are still sleeping. Yeah. Then some dude decides to eat an MRE while his guys are throwing up. You're like, dude, there's a special place for you, man. Right?
How do you do that?
But guys are doing like, yeah, I was hungry. Yeah. You know, I'm like, dude, you're eating, you know, chicken a la king out of a, you know.
Ugh.
I know. It just makes you, like, the things you see. You know, the things you see. And then so jump masters, yep, get guys ready to jump and then certify that they're good to go through this process called JMPI, jump master inspection of personnel and equipment. You know, you get JMPI'd and you slap that guy or that gal on the butt and you say, have a nice jump. And that's your seal of approval. That tells that jumper and instills confidence in him that he's good to go, that his stuff is right. Anyway. So I digress. Yeah. But anyway, so go on. You get through jump master school, and then what happens?
So I spent about another year in Italy after that. Left there senior rated. Made my way to Fort Bragg. Spent about 2.5 years at Fort Bragg, and came down on orders to go back overseas. I went to Germany. And it was right at the time when they did the 11 Bravo level mic mixture. And I was one of the first 11 Bravos to go to a armored unit. So here I show up, and I'm at this point now I'm master rated, and I show up over there, and I'm in, you know, kind of a weird place because everybody there has been all on Bradleys their whole time. And I've been in light infantry and airborne units. So, and that's, I ended up deploying to Iraq with them. And then after that, I came back and, I was on orders to be a drill sergeant, at Fort Benning. And I got there and, they said it was going to be about 8 month to a year wait before I went to school. So they said, go find a job if you want. So I walked over to the airborne school and, basically they asked me, you know, can I run 5 miles at 9 minute pace? And I said, yep. And they said, good, you're hired. And so I spent some time there as an airborne instructor. I was a master trainer for week one at Ground Branch. So basically overseeing all the each group of each company that came through every week, different company, you know, I had to observe their classes, critique the instructors on them, you know, give them their feedback, and just make sure the overall operations of everything ran. And then from there, I got pulled up to be a Pathfinder instructor. Wow. For my last a little over a year before I left there, and then went back to Germany again and was with U.S. Army Africa Command. And I did, you know, some stuff with Special Operations Command Africa, mm-hmm, there as well, you know, helping them out. I was the only Pathfinder qualified guy at the time in the entire command. So I had helped them out because everybody was just standing up. So they're still getting new people in every day over there. And it's a higher level combatant command.
Yeah.
And so I helped them out with doing some stuff, you know, down on the continent of Africa, with some different surveys, back and forth. I was, you know, set up as a program coordinator for the, NEO, the non-combatant evacuations. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of stuff down there with that in different areas, and then left there and went back to the regular army. For my last 3 years, I was stationed in Alaska. I was at the NCO Academy there, where I was a senior instructor, senior small group leader, they call it. I was a quality assurance officer, and then retired out of there. And they took the uniform off on a Friday, put civilian clothes on Monday, doing the same job.
Well, so let me say a few things about that folks that listen might not, you know what it is. But you were a Pathfinder, which Pathfinder is another school, and once you graduate from Pathfinder school, I was never in Pathfinder school, but these are guys that basically set up landing zones, right? And for various different aircraft, and also you know, control drop zones, right? Mm-hmm. And that whole thing for parachute operations and you know, even resupplies and things like this, right? So that's a pretty cool skill set. So you are a highly trained non-commissioned officer. You're jump master, Pathfinder, you know, no doubt earned the combat infantryman's badge for actions in combat. So, you know, tell us about your combat deployment. Now, I remember reading your bio, and I think weren't you in combat right around the 05, 06, the 2005, 06 timeframe? Is that right?
No, I was there before that. So I deployed with 1st Armored Division out of Freiburg, okay. Germany. I was with 136 Infantry. And that's why I said when I left Fort Bragg and went over there, I was in a display. So they didn't put me as a Bradley commander or anything. They stuck me as a dismount squad okay. leader. Because at that point, I'm doing regular standard squad leader jobs on the ground when you get out right. back at Bradley's. And so when we deployed over there, I was to start with, I was tasked with helping train a lot of the other like the tankers and a lot of the other ones on entering and clearing houses, different techniques. And then when we, you know, that was all in Kuwait, and then we went up there in May of 03 and spent our time up in Baghdad for I'd say 90% of the time there. We did, you know, other little things around the area, and then we were actually about, I think it was about 10 days from going home in 2004.
That's what it was. And, it was 04. You were on the wrong side of that stick, weren't you? You guys were getting ready. Yeah. I remember. I'll never forget that because I was at SOCOM at the time, and they did that to a couple units. The Army did. They said, okay, it was supposed to be a 12-month deployment, right? A year long. So everybody's getting close. No, you know, and everybody's looking at their watch, like, okay, you know, it, you know, four more and a wake up, and you're out of here. And then the Army says, in its infinite wisdom, you're being extended for 3 months. You were part of that.
Morale goes
right through the ceiling at that point, doesn't it?
It did. So, and even before that, you know, about the 6 month mark, maybe even 4 month mark in our platoon sergeant, he had they moved him to another position up in the battalion, and so I took over as being the platoon sergeant at that point. And then we had a platoon leader who left, and so we didn't have a platoon leader come in, so they put me. I was platoon sergeant and platoon leader for a while. Lucky day there. So I did that for a while. We got a platoon leader in, and I stayed as platoon sergeant the rest of the time. And at the about 10 days from going home, our Bradleys are already gone back down to Kuwait. We're basically living out of a duffel bag and a rucksack, and waiting on our flight, basically, or our ride. And you know, we got the word, hey, you're getting extended. Your Bradleys are on their way back from Kuwait. And we got extended and got sent to Karbala for we were down there for about 45 to 60 days, somewhere in that area.
Karbala.
Yeah, and that was,
sorry, you're challenging my geographic abilities here. Karbala. Where is Karbala?
Yeah. Karbala is, I think it's like a little southwest. I might be a little bit wrong on that direction of Baghdad.
All right. Southwest of Baghdad.
It's where they got their Iraq's big holy mosque, the golden, where they do. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but it's like where their big holy mosques are down there. And so they just had a lot of insurrection stuff going on there at the time. So we got extended along with some others as well did. And we got sent down there to, you know, help take out the militia and everything. And that's about 10 days after being there, 10, 15 days after being there. We had, you know, lots of gunfighting going on. We'll put it that way. I think my Bradley, I shot about 1,000 to 1,500 rounds of 25 Mike through it in the city. Tank rounds, like 105 rounds, were actually being shot in the city. Javelins were being deployed in the city. It was pretty crazy. And then, you know, one of the days, May 14th is the day that I got injured. We were unloading some stuff out of the back of the Bradley, and I was standing at the ramp was down, and you're looking into it. I was standing at the rear left of it, and a 6mm mortar round hit the rear left road wheel is, throwing shrapnel through my legs, and a little bit in a couple pieces in my hands. Hitting my gunner and my driver as well. But that was a pretty bad day across our platoon, actually across the company as well. But our platoon, we had 14 injured in my platoon in that day, various things. Some had to be medevaced out, where they did not come back. Some were returned to duty and, you know, went back and got patched up. Some had to be out for a few days and came back and they were fine.
So. Did you hear the thump before the bang? Did you know?
I felt a concussion. I felt a concussion first, like a shockwave.
But you didn't hear the mortar go off. Like you didn't hear it.
I did not.
So it was the complete surprise.
Complete surprise. The only thing I heard afterwards was sounded like, if you watch the movie Saving Private Ryan, where he got his bell rung
in slow motion.
That's kind of what it felt like for a few minutes, you know, and just ringing like constant, after that. So,
well, God bless you, man. I mean, if that deployment had gone as advertised, you wouldn't have been there. True story, right?
True story.
Back home, you know, and having survived a year in combat, and then the Army in its infinite wisdom extends you for 3 months and you almost almost die. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I said when I left to go over there, I said, there's three awards that I don't want. You know, I said, I don't want a Medal of Honor because a lot of times you're not making it home. You know, I don't want the POW ribbon because I don't want to be captured. And I say, and I don't want a Purple Heart, but
I think it was General Petraeus who said first, that I heard anyway, I mean, that about the Purple Heart, you know, he said it's the one award that is respected by all and sought by none. I don't think you can say it any better than that. And that's true. I mean, it's the foundation from which, you know, I built this organization, because I, you know, I had such a huge amount of respect for our service members who do get wounded in combat. So I want to thank you personally and publicly here.
Thank you.
You know, for your service to our country during wartime and you know for being there and calling the answering the call of duty. That's big stuff in my book, and I know it's big stuff and our listening audience from their perspective as well. So Jason, thank you very much for, you know, what you did for our country. And notwithstanding, thank you. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that you're a professional soldier. And that's the other thing is most people don't, you know, get it. Like, hey, if you did a 3-year tour, right? And which is most enlistments, 3 to 5 years, depending on what you sign up for. You know, by that time, you might be as an enlisted guy, you might be a E5, maybe, you know, maybe going for E5, something like that. But then, you know, you re-up and you sign another contract and you get, another 3-5 years, whatever you sign up for. And you did that, you know, what, 3-4 times before you, you know, became a professional soldier with 20 years of, you know, active. What, did you do 20 years and 20 minutes like me? What'd you do?
20 years and 25 20
years
days.
And 25 days. God bless you. You know, and retire at the rank of, you know, E7 after, you know, multiple permanent changes of station, you know, everywhere from, you know, Fort Drum, Alaska, you know, to the 82nd Airborne, you know, out of Bragg. And I guess not that that's now renamed something else.
Liberty.
You were up in Alaska. You were overseas in Germany. You did all these wonderful things for your country. And then on a combat deployment at the last moment, you know, when all your stuff is already packed and moving out back stateside in the Army, you know, tells you that you're being extended for 3 months. So you get extended for 3 months. They move you to another place and you get blown up. Yeah, that's it. There you go. Right. That's the wave tops. But, you know, God bless you for, you know, what you've done. That's your military career. I mean, you were a professional soldier, professional NCO, and as an officer, you know, I tell you, guys like you are just invaluable, man. Invaluable. Like, you are the guy that guys like me lean on. You know, I used to lean on and go, you know, pull you aside and go, hey Sergeant, let's chat about this, man. You know, let's go take a walk. We need, you know, right? That's the beauty of the relationship between officers and, you know, and senior non-commissioned officers is you're the guy that's going to take the guidance and turn it into reality. You know, you're the guy that's closest to the troops, closest to, you know, I mean, you're the guy that's going to make it happen. And you know, I've just always so admired professional NCOs that do their business and do it well. Everything from, you know, hey, Jumpmaster, Pathfinder, you know, all the things that you know about weapon systems and how to employ them, the things that you know about soldiers, you know, Joe, if you will, and how to lead them. You know, you grew up through the ranks and are, you know, the guys that make it happen. And, you know, I just always admired guys like you, and I want to thank you and the rest of the great NCOs that are out there, professional soldiers, professional Marines, you know, that are doing that work, because it's not easy work. It is not easy work. And anybody who's thinking about a career, you know, in the service, I would highly encourage you to do it. Our country needs you now more than ever. This is my opinion in the year of 2024. You know, you're going to learn a great, I'm not recruiting, sound like a great commercial here, you know, right? But that's true, man. I mean, if you think about it, right? I mean, that's how you become a man. You know, you grew up there, you learn a lot and you have, you know, I took a little of the good and a little of the bad from everybody, the officer corps, the NCO corps. I mean, you learn and you have, you know, share these common experiences. These are very, very difficult things that our country asks you to do, you know, and it's all fun and games until, until the first shot goes off. Right. And then it gets.
It's all frag after that.
And then it gets real, real quick. And so, you know, thanks for what you did for our country, man. I appreciate it. You have a family. Tell us a little bit about your family, please.
So, yes, I am married. I've been married almost 20 years. My wife, Julie, we both met in Germany. She was also a soldier.
Oh, cool.
She was an MP, and I always joke when people ask how we met that she arrested me. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's kind of fitting for a, you know, MP and the infantry, you know, yeah, I can see why you got arrested, but yeah. No, you know, she didn't arrest me.
For the record.
For the record. And then we have a son who he will be 21 next week, actually. And he was actually born 3 weeks before we deployed to Iraq in 2003. So I got to spend the first 3 weeks there with him, and then seen him at 6 months, and then seen him at 15 months.
Yeah, that's the other thing that people don't realize about, you know, the service is how hard it can be on families. I mean, you know, your Julie has a, you know, your first, you know, born son, and then 3 months later, dad's gone, you know, then 6 months later, he's back. And then, you know, 8 months later, he's gone. You know, and that's just, you know, that's tough on family. So God bless Julie and yeah. you know, all the wonderful wives and caretakers and supporters, you know, whether they're men or women supporting their soldier or their Marine, or their airmen, fill in the blank, or even the space guys. Now we got Space Force. Now, how about that?
Space guys.
That's awesome. Okay. And so there you go. And then, your work, tell us a little bit, we'll talk about the WWI here in a minute. But you know, what are you doing now? What's going on? Are you working? Tell us about that.
I am working. So when I retired, I was at the NCO Academy in Alaska. And like I said, I took the uniform off on Friday and put civilian clothes on, doing the exact same job. Just changed from sergeant to mister at that point. I was the deputy chief of training for the NCO Academy. Basically, I was overseeing all the students coming in. You know, we had a little over 100 each month come through the NCO Academy up there. They went through their training for their basic mm-hmm. leader course. So I kind of overseen like all the student operations mm-hmm. kind of stuff, if you want to call it that. And after about 5 years there, you know, my wife and I both were in a way getting a little tired of the cold. So we decided to make the trek south after, you know, mm-hmm. a few months of deciding where we're going to go. And we moved to South mm-hmm. Carolina. So I'm just outside of Charleston mm-hmm. here. And, you know, we decided to take about a month off because I, you know, in over 25 years, I didn't, the longest I'd taken off was like a couple weeks on leave here and there. So I decided to take a little bit of a break after we moved here and then started looking for a job. And I got hired by the Department of the Navy mm-hmm. here, where I do human resources now. So a mm-hmm. Human resource specialist, hire civilians. It's a civilian command in our Navy. We don't got a lot of military here. But it's mainly all civilians. And so I do human resources here for mm-hmm. them, bringing people on board and supporting the warfighter out at sea. And
that's cool.
So, yeah.
You know, those, you can't see this because there's no video, but, you know, we've got this thing, this podcast. I can see Jason. He can see me. You know, obviously, we can hear each other. We both have headsets on. I'm in my office in Apollo Beach, and you're in your, what is it?
I'm in my house, okay. My home right now. So like we do, you know, luckily, well, I'm saying luckily, but you know, when COVID mm-hmm. had happened, you know, we were all going in the office 4 days a week, at mm-hmm. least, you know, some people were allowed to telework a day, mm-hmm. maybe 2 days a week. And then when COVID happened, they sent everybody home, mm-hmm. you know, and said, we're going to figure it out. We'll be back to work here in 2 weeks. Don't worry. You know, and here we are 4 years later. They've realized that the telework environment for us works pretty good. I do still go in mm-hmm. once or twice a week, but, you know, that's mainly for team collaboration, you know, with fellow coworkers, you know, meetings. But for the most part, we do still work from home, which is a, you know, great advantage.
Yeah. You know, I never would have thought that we would continue to let folks would continue to work out of their house, but a lot of people are doing it, you know, and thanks to the power of technology, you know, it's possible. We did it in the foundation for darn near a year, you
yeah.
know, and we didn't skip much of a beat. But yeah, so. All right, man. Well, that's great. You're working. I love it. I love it. Yeah. And you got a military retirement. You got a you know, unfortunately, a disability you know, situation going on. I'm sure of it. But that's good. You're active, and part of your portfolio of work includes the volunteerism, the volunteer work that you do with the foundation, with the WWIA. So I like I said at the beginning, you've been through our guide school. Okay, so here in 18 years, this is the reality. In 18 years of doing this work, you know, serving, you know, well over 1,000 combat wounded veterans now, by providing world-class outdoor sporting activities aimed at helping, you know, our wounded veterans recover from their wartime injuries, physical, mental, emotional, et cetera. Through the power of the great outdoors, connecting you with each other, you know, connecting them with each other and communities who care. you know, that's what we do. That's what we've been doing. And in that same 18 years, we've selected a total of 25. In this guide school, we will add, you know, more, but we've selected 25 in 18 years guides, individuals, men and women, to guide our events, go through our guide school, you know, 10-day guide school course, and get some holy water sprinkled on you, and then you go out and you do these missions, you know, in 30 some odd states and 42 independent missions, leading your peers in the field and in the waterways on these WWI events that are enabled by volunteer hosts all across the country. So that's what you're doing now as a volunteer. That's a very thin slice, you know, 25 guys and one woman so far who've been through our guide school, and we've seen thousands of combat wounded veterans, and you are one of the chosen that have made it to this position. And that to me is just remarkable. You know, congratulations. It is. You know, because I didn't select you, man. You were selected by your peers. You know, the current guide staff, I approved it. Okay, I'm not saying I was removed from it, because that's not true. I approve the guide slate and who gets to go to guide school, you know, and the curriculum that you get taught while you're there. That's got my name on it. But I didn't say, you know, hey, Red Rover, let Jason Gaudette come over. somebody else did that, right. You know. And that's impressive, man. I mean, you're an impressive man, and thanks for what you do. So tell us about your experience with the foundation. You know, what does it mean to you, man?
So first, when I heard about the organization, I didn't really know what it was, what it entailed, because, you know, there's all different kinds of organizations out there, do just different things. Mm-hmm. And so a friend of mine had told me about the organization. And told me I should sign up for one of the events. And this was in, I don't know, early 2019, late 2018, okay, some time frame. And, you know, I got selected to go on an event shortly after before we moved here to South Carolina. And
was it Erie? Did you go on Erie?
It was. So that was the very first event I went on as one of the heroes. And, you know, that event is so moving. I've been back there a couple times as a guide for it. And it is just such a moving event. The way that the community gets involved, the host, all the heroes that go there just have the time of their lives. And it was on that one where, you know, the first night when everybody's there and we go into the American Legion, mm-hmm, and I was thrown back on the outpouring of, generosity and how everything worked. And mm-hmm, actually I had to take a step out and go outside, and I called my wife and I said, as I told her, so you wouldn't believe what's happening here, you know. Just I kind of gave her a quick synopsis so I could get back in there, and I called her afterwards and I said, you know what, I said, I need to find a way that I can give back, something that I could do, because I haven't done anything, you know. I show mm-hmm up every day, put clothes on, go to work, and think nothing of it, you know. And so I told her, I said, I got to find a way. And she basically said, okay, figure it out, you know, do whatever. So, and I talked to the guy on that one, there was Frenchie.
And, okay, Johnny Frenchie, and, God bless him.
He's a great man, great American.
He sure is.
And I asked him, I said, hey, I was like, what do I got to do what you're doing? I said, I like the mission that this organization has. I like what they're doing. You know, I was like, I want to be able to do something like what you're doing. And so, you know, he kind of explained it to me, and, you know, we went on mm-hmm about the weekend, had a great time, you know, and then got contacted afterwards. And, you know, from there, it's, you know, history, you know, left seat, right seat rides, and, mm-hmm, you know, through COVID and everything else, and bring us to where we are now. And, every chance I get, somebody I talk to, you know, you know, I let them know about the organization the best that I can. I've got a couple people around the area here where I'm at who've done some little donation jars, you know, to send some stuff in. But I mean, I love it. It doesn't matter to me what event, you know, I go on. I'm going because I love the opportunity to, you know, get to meet all the different heroes out there. listen to them, talk with them, the host, the community, you know, and just be able to give back in a way that in my heart that it feels right to do. You know, serving as kind of as a mentor. Some of these guys, you know, as I told my wife when I said a lot of these guys are they live in in whatever hills, Montana or Wyoming, yeah, and they've been out. They've been out of the military for, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years, maybe even a little bit longer. And the only person that they've seen in uniform is maybe a recruiter or that National Guardsman, you know, driving down the road. And it's good for them to get back in with like-minded people.
Yeah.
You know, it gives them, they have a chance to open up and talk and let loose of some things that, you know, may have been there with them for a while. And they go home and they are new men and women for the most part.
Well, you know, you said something, I wrote it down. I'm just going to say it again, man. You know, this is just, I had to snicker, not because it was funny, but it's ironic. You know, you said you were talking to your wife, Julie, you know, you stepped out of the American Legion, probably a little overwhelmed by, you know, with feelings and what you were seeing. You know, that Team Erie there is amazing, you know, as are all of the events that we do. But this one's on the, you know, on the South Shore of Erie, in the, you know, in the Ashtabula, Ohio area, where you guys go out on Lake Erie and fish for walleye. And of course they engage the community. You know, the American Legion is involved, you know, other service, you know, organizations are involved. You know, there's a police escort to, you know, you guys go out in the boats and they're, you know, the fire department supporting that. There's an, you know, there's a motorcade, you know, there's flags everywhere. I mean, it just couldn't get any better. You know, it's America, man. I mean, and this is the outpouring of Americans. You know, I had nothing to do with that. You know, I mean, it wasn't my idea. You know, I certainly supported it. We may have shaped it a little bit, but you know, you got all these great Americans, you know, that are pulling this off. You know, in Ashtabula and in and around you know, that area in Ohio, you guys go out in these, you know, large sport fishing vessels to go fish for walleye in Lake Erie, and everybody comes home, you know, with a ton of beautiful, delicious walleye, and, you know, and they get packed, cleaned and packed and sent home. Everybody goes home with fish and to feed their families. And, you know, anyway, you said you step outside of the, you know, was it the American Legion?
It's American Legion. Yeah.
Yeah. You step outside of the American Legion, call Julie, your wife, and say, you know, I got to figure out a way to get involved in this. But you said, you know, I haven't done anything. I go, I haven't done anything. You served your country, got blown up. You know, right. And you haven't done anything. Right. I mean, that makes me snicker, you know, but you have a servant's heart, you know, as we all do. You wouldn't be where you are. Like, I'm not done giving, you know, I served my country for 20 years, but you know, I had the same feeling, like, you know, when I went up to James A. Haley Poly Trauma Center, while I was at Special Operations Command here in Tampa, you know, I went up there, you know, at the height of the war, you know, 05, 06 timeframe, I used to go up there a lot and, you know, to the, you know, met the recreational therapist up there. And I used to visit the, you know, the ward where, you know, it's a polytrauma center. So, you know, traumatic brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. And, you know, it was at the height of the war. And, you know, by the time the guys get there, they've already been through, you know, three or four triage, you know, different levels of triage. But by the time they get to a polytrauma center, you know, the reality of the rest of their life sets in. You know, you got guys up there chewing on rubber balls so they don't swallow their tongue. Mm-hmm. And you got, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-old guys surrounded by, you know, their girlfriends, their moms, their dads, their brothers, their sisters, you know, hoping that, you know, that this wonderful American soldier or Marine is going to be okay. You know, and it was at that point that I said, you know, I got to do something. Like, you know, I'm still wearing a uniform, you know, but like you, like, I feel like I still got something I got to do or could do or should do. And so that's just an amazing feeling, you know, and it's an amazing phenomenon. You know, I haven't done anything. It's just what, you know, I got to write that quote down and put it on my wall. You know, I haven't done anything, you know, Jason Gaudet, you know, that's wonderful. Anyway, listen, thanks for all you do. You know, behind you is, you know, a bunch of, I see a bear, I see multiple, you know, European mounts from white-tailed deers, you know, these big monster bucks. There looks like a snow geese or a goose or something behind you as well. I mean, you are a sportsman. You're an American hero. You are leading your peers in the field. You've been through our guide school. You know, all these wonderful things. I'm just super proud of you, and I want you to know how much you know, you mean to me and to the foundation. Your work is amazing. Keep doing what you're doing, man.
I appreciate it, John. Thanks. Yeah, you know, and like I said, every day, you know, it's every day is a new day. You wake up and put on, and now it's, you know, you just got to have that mindset of what can I do?
That's, you know, right. What can I do? And for everybody out there, you know, I don't care who you are or what you're doing. That's the thing. What can I do? You got to ask yourself that every day. You know, what can I do? What can I do to make a difference? Right?
Yeah.
That's just brilliant, buddy. Well, listen, best of luck to you. You know, I'm here for you. If you ever need anything, you just keep being you, buddy.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time today.
All right. All right, bye.
To learn more about the mission of the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation and how you can get involved, please visit our website at wwiaf.org or follow our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you for listening to the WWIA podcast and for helping us honor, connect, and heal our combat wounded Purple Heart heroes through the power of the great outdoors.
If you like what you're listening to here and would like to join our team in our mission to bring healing power and recovery to America's Purple Heart heroes, please become part of our Sponsor a Hero team by clicking on the link in the podcast notes or by going to wwiaf.org/sponsor. That's wwiaf.org/sponsor. Our heroes need you now more than ever. Thank you.